Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Playwright Lydia Diamond has set her work in Slave Days. She's brought Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison's work to the stage in The Bluest Eye. Her play, Stickfly, playing now, is as up-to-date as an Ivy League black president and first lady in the White House. It's set in the big summer house of an affluent, upper-crust African-American family, where the money is deep, the banter is fast, and history is still there in every room. This hour, On Point playwright Lydia Diamond and Stickfly. You can join the conversation. What's the African-American insight, the African-American voice you need to hear in drama today? Is it odd to have thug life in the music and neurosurgeons on the stage, or is that just natural? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is playwright Lydia Diamond. Her plays include Harriet Jacobs, Lizzie Stranton, Voyeurs de Venus, The Bluest Eye, The Gift Horse. Her play Stickfly, now being performed at the Huntington Theater in Boston after runs in Los Angeles, Chicago, Princeton, New Jersey, and Washington, won the Black Theater Alliance Award for Best Play. She's Assistant Professor of Playwriting and Theater Arts at Boston University. Lydia Diamond, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
I saw the play the other night, and I absolutely loved it. Just terrific. Can't wait to talk about it. We are also delighted to be joined by two of the actresses from Stickfly. Nicole Salter is co-author and performer of the off-Broadway production In the Continuum. She serves as executive director of the nonprofit group The Continuum Project, which provides artistic programming for the enrichment of communities. In Lydia Diamond's play Stickfly, she plays Taylor. We'll talk about that character. Nicole, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And with us is Rosie Benton. She has appeared on and off Broadway in plays such as Accent on Youth and Saturn Returns. She plays Kimber in Lydia Diamond's play Stickfly, currently being performed at the Huntington Theater. Rosie Benton, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, okay, let's just get the palette straight. You're the white girl in the play.
I think I am.
Okay. You and Nicole are both... the girls, the girlfriends, the fiancés being brought home by the well-heeled sons of the
outsiders.
The outsiders mm-hmm. coming to the LeVay family. Lydia Diamond, you've set it all up. It's on Martha's Vineyard, the island just off Cape Cod, for those listeners not in the Boston area or who haven't been fortunate enough. Very lovely place to be. And here's quite an affluent African-American family. The father is a neurosurgeon. And how did this great big house on Martha's Vineyard come into the family, Lydia, in your play?
Well, actually, so it's a fictional family.
Well, of
and
course.
It's set in a fictional town that most closely resembles Edgartown.
Oak Bluffs, which has for centuries been a kind of African-American elite enclave in the summers on Martha's Vineyard. It's even like upper crustier than that somehow.
Or at the very least, plays a role in the family's perception of itself mm-hmm. and the way it fits into its community and its world.
They're in a white town.
They're in a white town and have been for generations and generations.
And I love the story of how this house came into... not the neurosurgeon, Dr. LeVay's hands, but into his wife's family's hands decades earlier. Tell us that in your play.
Oh, okay. It might even be another play one day, but this is the patriarch, like the great-great-grandfather, was a sea captain and saved the town's mayor's son in a boating accident.
Way back when.
Way, way, way back, many generations prior. As an expression of gratitude, the mayor gave them the land on which they built the house that's been there for generations. And it's actually Dr. LeVay, the neurosurgeon's mm-hmm. wife's family's house.
Yes, very,
which is
very
another
pointedly
part of the dynamic.
So.
Yes, mm.
She brings the house, as he reminds his sons, it seems all the time in the play, he's brought the money in this marriage all these years and kept everything afloat. You've written plays, I mean, you've done Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye slave setting. You've had your own slave settings, historical settings where the African-American characters were anything but on top of the economy. How did you decide to sort of shift your focus to this upper crusty, very highly educated, kind of pale, black, rich, or at least quite affluent family and setting?
Well, what's interesting actually is that it's actually not a shift. It's weird in the world of theater. You write a play and then it sort of emerges into the world on its own timeline. But prior to doing The Bluest Eye, which is set in 1941, Lorain, Ohio, mm-hmm. and prior to doing Harriet Jacobs, which is
very old,
about the story of Harriet Jacobs, mm-hmm. I had a real commitment to putting contemporary images of African Americans on stage in a way that they hadn't been previously. You know, you talked about sort of the thug life things versus what's on the stage, but usually there really haven't been very many depictions of African Americans on stage in a way that wasn't sort of directly related to the foot of the white man on their necks, usually in very rural, very poor settings.
I think
or
of
very
the first scene being, you know, some guy kind of on the run with ragged clothes comes on stage, black man in trouble, certainly not affluent, and to me that's a kind of a stereotypical opening of an African American playwright's play.
Absolutely.
Back when.
And I think that what happened is that I evolved a little bit because I had a little bit discounted the importance of those plays in my desire to fill this void that I saw. What I've since decided is that the problem is the plays that depict us in contemporary settings and that sort of challenge the mass media's notions of what African Americans are don't get produced as much as they should. And so the onus is upon the artist in a way that I don't think is fair.
Of course, there's a long-running drama in front of everyone's eyes right now in the White House.
Right, right.
Ivy League educated president, first lady, just about as grand a stage as you could be on.
Absolutely. So, and I guess I'm just saying I think it's important that we can tell our history, the story of our history in all of its socioeconomic dynamic. So that's what
absolutely.
We're trying to do.
Absolutely, and it's totally wonderful and fascinating to have it. It seems obvious and natural and very contemporary. Let's get a little more of the story on the table. So we're in this big house on Martha's Vineyard. It's a really affluent place. There's a maid, though she's sick and offstage. Her daughter, though, has shown up to take care of the affluent family. There's Dr. LaVey. There's two sons, Flip, the elder, kind of player, playboy, 30-something years old. Spoon, the younger, more sincere, younger brother. And ultimately, they're the younger brother's fiance, that's you, Nicole Salter, playing mm-hmm. Taylor, and the older player brother's white girlfriend, Rosie, Kimber, that's you, Rosie mm-hmm. Benton. Nicole, tell us, if you'd be good enough, about the character you play in this drama. You bring a very important twist to it in what, family background terms, class terms, almost color terms.
Yeah, I think Taylor is very much an outsider, not just to this particular family, but to the the media's stereotypical image of what it means to be black. You know, here's a person who is a scientist, and mm-hmm. she's a woman.
Entomologist. She's tracking down
she's
insects all the time.
Yeah, so that's not things that girls do. It's not things that black people do. It's not things that black urban people do. Like, she doesn't quite fit that, although that was her upbringing. She also doesn't fit with the people that she was educated with, you know, on in academic terms. Yes, she's in classes with them. She's educated with them. But when it comes to
she was
time
quite
to,
highly educated and quite elite educational
exactly.
studies.
Exactly.
Harvard, I think.
Harvard was her undergraduate experience.
She brought a chip on her shoulder to that.
I think she brought an expectation in many ways, a personal expectation and a societal expectation. I think that she'd been damaged very much by the rejection of her father, who was a part of that upper crust.
Though
he
was not the neurosurgeon.
He was like the
one
Cornel
who wrote
West.
About black power, kind of.
Right, but he's still like the Cornel
yes,
West. So
who ditched her.
For a new family.
Left her to economic struggle with her mother.
Exactly. So she has that, if you will call it a chip, I call it damage.
Okay.
She has that
either way.
Damage
I'm still afraid of you after seeing
with.
The play, so whatever you say. Interestingly, she brings, this may sound weird, but she's kind of blacker than the family, or more street black than the family, if you know what I mean.
I think that she has more of the need to do what we call code shifting in the world. I think that she I imagine, I mean, here's the playwright, so correct me at any point in time. Right. But I imagine that she grew up in a place that was more urban, a little more funky, a little more sassy, a little more thug life.
A little more angry.
Experience.
And so the younger son is bringing, the tension here is he's bringing that into this upper crust family.
Yeah. Well, but I also think that she was educated in these very kind of elite, very kind of remote
Absolutely.
Places. So
she's
she goes home
it.
To one place.
Yeah.
Her mother functions in politics and infrastructure, so she goes. She has that. She has a father who is writing all about
famous
the
black man
power
scholar.
Movement, yep. you know, and the black freedom movement, mm-hmm. but yet he doesn't live there.
He wasn't there for her. And the other woman who comes in is white, or as they say in the play, Rosie, when you come in playing Amber, the pre-introduction you get to the family to kind of ease it in is she's Italian.
Yeah.
But you're not Italian in this
no,
play. You're anything but. Tell us about the Kimber character.
Well, Kimber is a sort of She's from a very, very wealthy family, a New York family. Her people have a house in Kennebunkport, obviously spent all summers there. You know, it's just
posh,
extremely posh. Went to, you know, all the boarding schools. I picked that she went to Columbia. That was up to me. So.
In your mind's eye.
Right. You know, and I grew up with a lot of these women in Connecticut, so I can sort of see, you know, she always wanted to not end up like a lot of the girls that she grew up with, a lot of the women she grew up with, and I think she's looking for a way to be different and be a part of something greater than her upbringing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with playwright Lydia Diamond and some of the cast, and soon the director of her play, Stick Fly, about her work and the African-American voice in American theater today. Lydia Diamond joins me in the studio, along with two actresses from Stick Fly's current production in Boston at the Huntington Theater. Nicole Salter is with us. She plays Taylor, one of the girlfriend in the play. Fiance. Rosie Benton is here. She plays Kimber, the girlfriend, the white girlfriend in the play. We have some tape from the this production of the play. It's been all over the country in Boston right now, but let's hear a scene where the father, the neurosurgeon, Dr. Joseph LeVay, played by Wendell W. Wright, talks with one of his sons, the elder, the player, the playboy, Flip, played by Billy Eugene Jones. And the father, Joseph, here is telling the story of how he met Flip's mother, who, interestingly, is not at the house. And then Flip tells his father that he's expecting his white girlfriend to visit for the weekend. Listen to how he eases that in.
We've all heard this story, Dad.
It was one of those brown bag petitions.
Yeah, you've told us.
You know, you went and hold a bag up to your face.
Many times.
And run a comb through your hair. And if the comb can't get through or the bag's lighter than you, well, then
clearly you're at the wrong party.
So I fail on both sides, and I'll never forget this.
This yellow-waisted girl in an ugly, bright pink dress.
Is saying, I'm sorry, Dr. LeVay, but I'm not allowed. You understand? And just then, this beautiful woman.
In a blue dress with long brown curls and gray eyes and
Hey, let me tell the story. This beautiful woman walks in and says, Dr. LeVay, I read about you in last month's Harvard Review, and I cannot believe you are going to stand there and let that turn you away. I would have danced with you. And she went on and on.
Fine. And did you get in?
Hell no, but I got your mama's name and number,
and the rest is history. So, my friend is Italian.
You mean she's white?
She's Italian.
Oh, well. She here? Mm.
She's coming tomorrow.
You wanted to lay the groundwork with your mama, huh?
Well, we're both of you. I just thought it would be good if you know.
You sound embarrassed.
No, just aware.
Wendell Wright and Billy Eugene Jones in Lydia Diamond's stick fly. And I have to say, the second line, "Oh, she's Italian," is in fact, in the play, I was there, a big laugh line.
I milk it, don't I?
You milk it, and the audience was all over it. There really is a ton of comedy in this play, and it's just terrific to see. You're setting up more than we know in the father's old story that the son has heard a million times about how he met the mother who is not present. And you've got some generational tension there, and suddenly, click, the color tension is there. White character not on stage yet, but there is that long pause, and we heard it when the father hears, even though these are people, and this is one of the interesting things to me, these are people who live and work and study in a mixed world, white world, all the time.
Absolutely.
But here's an intimate moment that we get to see inside this family. What do you want us to know about that injection of the white character into the black household?
Well, I think it mostly, and first of all, that it's not unusual. It's certainly a dynamic in my family and in most families now of African Americans that I know. I think it's interesting also the contradiction that these are people who have grown up and who have lived in a very, very white world. And in that one little short scene, we see tensions around color lines within the black community, and we see
the paper bag reference.
Absolutely, that was real.
I had to think about that. Your skin had to be lighter than a brown paper bag to get into the cotillion that he was off to?
To get into certain cotillions, yes.
And he hadn't been light enough.
He's not light enough.
Though he's pretty light on it.
Well, that's casting, and he's the brilliant actor. We needed a brilliant actor.
I'll take it. Yeah. You know, we've got the director of this production of the play with us right now. We're very happy to have him. If you'd stand by for just a moment, Kenny Leon joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. He's director of Stick Fly at the Huntington Theater Company's performance. He's directed performances on Broadway, around the country, regional theaters. He's directed plenty of August Wilson, Radio Golf, Gem of the Ocean, Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry. I mean, some of the greats. This coming April, he will direct Denzel Washington in Fences on Broadway. Kenny Leon, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Lydia. How you guys doing?
Hey.
Everybody's great. We're all having fun. Kenny Leon, we'd appreciate it if you would put Lydia's plays, this play in particular, kind of in the spectrum of African-American drama, you know, from Raisin in the Sun right on through August Wilson. What do you see coming with Lydia?
Well, number one is that Lydia is... since you mentioned August Wilson, mm-hmm. One thing that this country does a lot is sort of marginalize African-American writers. And I hope to God we don't start doing that with Lydia Diamond, because I think her work is just it's universal. It hits on so many themes that all at once. And
I can vouch for that. Very, very clearly.
At the same time, you're laughing as you think on the themes, and long after you left the theater, you're still thinking about what you witnessed for the last 2 hours. So mm-hmm. I just think that Lydia, in my opinion, in the next, 2 years, I think that she's going to be a household name around America.
I say amen to that. You knew, worked with, directed August Wilson plays. She's described as a kind of successor. If that's true, what's the new phase that she represents, the new chapter, Kenny Leon?
Well, I don't know if she represents a chapter. It's like, we always say that many times it's like it's, with African-American writers, it's only one. There can only be one great African-American writer, and I've been talking with Regina Taylor and Lynn Nottage, and there's so many African American writers that have just finished writing new plays. We just have to continue to get the work out there. So with Lydia, I think what's interesting is the characters that she put in one room. You know, she put all these characters there, and the subject matter and the things that they talk about is very different than some of, say, the kitchen sink dramas like A Raisin in the Sun, or some of their older African-American work. But I think Lydia represents a breath of fresh air. And with that, I think it will bring us closer together, and race relations closer together, because she's painting a broader picture or image of what African American is or what it means in this country.
She's got some very fast banter in here. It's a family in a house for the weekend. Talk about a familiar theater setup. I mean, from Eugene O'Neill, Our Wilderness, you name it, just again and again. What's it like to direct this particular?
Oh, it's great, because I'm always a listener for the rhythms and the musicality of language, you know. And just like Wilson has his language, O'Neill has his language, Dave Mamet has his specific language. I think listening to Lydia is like these folks. It has a real rhythm and a musicality that is up tempo for the most part. It's overlapping. It's and it features some major arias at certain points. So it's a real music piece. And when I sit in the theater to listen to it, I'm almost sitting there like a conductor, you know. And I can tell when Rosie or Billy or mm-hmm. any one of the other actors, Nicole, when they're off the note and off that rhythm, you know. And but fortunately for us, on opening night, this play was, they were like a well-tuned orchestra, you know. And it's like the ensemble makes the piece. Any weak actor in this play exposes what the play really is, and it's written really well, but you need a really fine-tuned ensemble to deliver it, because they really have to work with each other.
Well, they are fine, and you've got them beautifully tuned. We're going to hear one of those arias you mentioned in just a moment. It's really a great production, just terrific. Kenny Leon in Atlanta, thank you so much for joining us for a few minutes today. We're really grateful. Great to have you.
Thank you so much.
Kenny Leon, director of Stick Flies, a production in Boston and beyond. I want to hear a little bit of you two really going at it, Rosie and Nicole. But to this question, I mean, you can hear Kenny really wants to make the point. Lydia Diamond is, yes, she's an African-American playwright, but she writes universal plays. I can see that very much in this play, Stick Fly. And at the same time, you are writing from that kind of seedbed. I mean, that's your material. Those are your characters in large part. I don't know. Is there a point at which an African-American playwright forgets that? Does any playwright get to forget where they're from, who they are? Can we get into some kind of high concept zone that's just universal period without coloration?
I don't know that we should set a paradigm that suggests mm-hmm. we should.
Mm-hmm,
I think I see the world through a lens that is very specifically African-American, mm-hmm. and it colors my work, but in a way that I think is really exciting and hopefully gives a little insight into sort of what the world might look
Absolutely.
Like from my perspective. Mm. My goal isn't for the telling of my story to be so universal that I somehow transcend blackness. I think it's a good thing to be black. I'm okay with that.
And how do you think about your audiences? Now, the night I saw it, and given this wasn't a regular night, maybe these were a lot of patrons of the theater or something there, but it was overwhelmingly white. When you're writing, as an American playwright today, and you want commercial success, on the other hand, there's all kinds of markets. How do you think about your audience? Does it matter? Is your audience just humanity?
It always matters. What we've noticed is that the dynamic in the theater is the most on fire when the audience is the most diverse.
Mm-hmm.
The dynamic actually is the African Americans in the audience who are laughing at things that are just natural for us to laugh about give the white people permission to laugh at things that otherwise they might think incriminated laughing with.
Yeah.
And then it's on. And then it becomes really a dialogue.
Though the cool thing was, it was a largely white audience, but I didn't feel it like alienated or cut off from the stage. I mean, we lived together and have for a long time, and people seem to flow pretty naturally into the laughter, into the insights, at least to my ear. A couple of people have talked about arias and moments on fire. There's a great one with the two actresses that are with us here today. Here's a scene where Kent LeVays, that's the younger, sensitive soul son, played by Jason Dearden, his fiance Taylor, played by Nicole Salter, and the older player, playboy son, Flip's girlfriend, White Kimber, kind of ratchet up the tension as they argue about education and their different upbringings. You'll hear plenty of bleeping before we're done with this. Let's hit it.
Here's what I don't get, Taylor. I work with black and Latino kids in the inner city.
I know you didn't.
Right, Taylor,
that
please.
Was my dissertation around inequalities in education. Anyway, I have a hard time feeling sorry for you, daughter of a famous intellectual.
Just by birth, he got a new family.
Anyway, I swear, some of the places these kids live, it's like a third world country.
Oh, and I'm sure you've seen plenty of those in the Peace Corps after you bummed around Europe.
Taylor.
What? She doesn't know me? You don't know me.
Can you shut her up?
It's okay, honey. I'm okay. Yes, so you know me well. Yes, Europe, Peace Corps. And so help me here. There you were at this privileged institution with your famous dad and your new laptop to soothe yourself, and you're upset because some stupid sorority chicks are mean to you?
Oh, God.
Seems like a fair question. So I'm gonna... Okay, there's coffee, decaf or regular in the kitchen.
No, Kimber. I was upset because people like you can't see it. Your inner city kids aren't supposed to succeed. As long as they can stay ignorant and dependent on you, they don't have to mess up the white spaces. They let one or two of us in who've had enough privilege to almost play the game. Just enough to make us think we're special. It's a grand mind. And then Kimmy here goes slumming for 5 minutes and knows all about it. You can kiss my black is what you can do with your I'm such a saint, inner sanctum of rebellious white liberal bullshit. Don't you ever come at me like that. You need to get your white out my world or keep your hippie drivel to your own damn self. I'll show Dad what happens if he won't notice me. I'm too deep for cotillions. I'll black and show them all.
Woo, okay.
can I say that my mother is cringing right now?
Well, she might be cringing more. She was in the theater, but the audience was into it. Talk about Aria. It really is on fire. There was a lot of laughter woven through there in the performance I saw as well. But in your Aria, Nicole, playing Taylor there, I mean, dead silence. You had everybody rapt. I don't know. You're an actress. I don't know if you're a method actress. when you ratchet up for that, where's that come from? Is it easy?
Yes. Yes, it is easy. It comes from a place of never... of never being allowed to have your own experience. You know, I think one of the things that kind of sets that off is the idea that here's a person who says your father is rich and educated mm-hmm. and famous and you can't have the experience that you claim that you're having.
You can't own it, and I'll frame it.
And I'll frame it. I'll frame it for you. And she's saying, no, you actually can't tell me what I feel. You actually don't know anything about me. And let me tell you how I feel in such a way that you will never forget it. Right?
Yes.
And
yes.
I think that as a African-American woman, a young African-American yes. woman, I have definitely experienced that before. I've never told anyone off like that.
Never, ever? Did it feel good?
Oh, no. It's always wonderful to be in a play where the playwright gives you words, because you never have the words in the moment.
Right.
Come on.
That's what you'd
someone
say later in the car
you
if you were
you,
really,
yeah,
really good.
Yeah, and you just stare at them, and then you go home, and you're driving. You're like, God, I should have said this, and I should have said that, and I should have told her this. But no, I think it's wonderful that in the moment, here's a character who's articulate enough to have the words and the balls.
Yeah. Yes, if we may say so. Hold it right at Rosie, you play the white girl who gets really smacked down in this scene, but very interestingly. I mean, here you're the kind of the patsy. But before it's all over, Lydia gives your character an awful lot of savvy herself. We'll get to that. But what was it like here to, you know, just walk straight into the buzzsaw?
I had the opposite experience. I found it extremely difficult just simply because... You know, you don't want to judge your characters. You know, you really want to come at them with real humanity. And this woman walks into a house and she confronts this other woman in a way that I believe when I do it on stage, I believe that it's to engage in a dialogue. Mm-hmm. And it just comes out very condescending and presumptuous. And she doesn't.
It is. You believe what you like.
And it's also a lot about women. You know, it's a lot about mm-hmm. how women act, especially with the men that they're, you know, that there's a little bit of claws come out,
sure.
tiny claws.
You're not going to give her an easy one up
right.
on you.
And, you know, to make the father like you, you know, mm-hmm. you don't want to be embarrassed in front of your future father-in-law. And I think for me, it's so refreshing to have that come back at you because you know that the play, it's like the top of a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. And you know the play is just going to zoom out and there's going to be a lot of really wonderful discussion that comes out of that because it's not over yet. It's just the beginning.
But Lydia, you cooked all this up in the kitchen, so you knew when that unfolded that later, I mean, you came to know that you were going to give Kimber an actually pretty savvy, tuned-in role in this play. Not just the straw girl to be knocked down.
Oh, absolutely not. Everybody in this play has to be flawed and brilliant, and that's drama.
Well, and I think another important thing is that it would be, what I think, you know, this needs to be a white person's play as much as it needs to be a black, it needs to be everyone's play. And so you can't have a white character that people can just topple over.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with playwright Lydia Diamond and some of the cast, and we heard from the director of her play, Stickfly, about her work and the African-American voice in American theater today. Lydia Diamond joins me in the studio along with two actresses from Stickfly. I just saw them this week. It's a terrific show. Nicole Salter is here. She plays Taylor, fiancée of one of the privileged sons of the LeVay family on Martha's Vineyard in this play. Rosie Benton is here. She plays Kimber, this kind of sort of hoity-toity white girl brought home by the older son, and things get very complicated. Let's go to our listeners. Daniel in Belmont, Massachusetts. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi, I saw one of Lydia Diamond's plays last year. I think it was Lily Stratton. And at the time, I was completely overwhelmed and thought, this is the next Beckett or something like that. And
my.
I'm a little angry because she didn't send me the comp she said she would. But I braved the monsoon last night and bought my last ticket that was available and went. And she's just brilliant, you know? She's just absolutely incredible. And as I said to her a year ago when I saw the other piece, as a white middle-aged man, I love watching this stuff because as an African-American woman, in part and because of who she is as a person, she can say and do things that almost nobody else could get away with. She is just pushing all the envelopes all the time. And it's brilliant, it's funny, it's moving. It's just...
Daniel, that's great. You've got her pumping her fist a little bit here in the studio. That freedom train. She's happy to be on it, I think.
Anybody has to go because you get to see... You can't go see Picasso paint. You know, he's gone. You can't see Mozart performing, you know, composing symphonies, but you can go and see this amazing playwright performing her stuff.
Oh, boy. Okay. Okay, now we got Picasso, Mozart, Beckett, and Lydia Diamond live.
Absolutely.
And on stage. Daniel, it's great to have the report from right last night and out of the monsoon. What about the freedom point? Maybe he's right. I mean,
that I'm so empowered by my blackness, I can say anything.
Well, is that weird or true?
You know, I think there's a little bit of truth. Actually, I think there's a lot of truth, and I think that sort of where it weighs out is that we don't actually get platforms from which to say these things with great freedom.
Hey, I'm looking at your CV here. You've had plays done all over the country. You still until it's on Broadway, you're not happy enough. What else do you want?
Oh, no, it's not.
I'm kind of pulling your leg, but have you felt difficulty finding venues for your plays?
I think that for a playwright, after there's the ability to write and some nice relationships with theater companies, sort of the planets have to align and the universe has to move in a certain way. And so everything else that happens in the career is completely outside of yourself. And I have been very, very lucky. I've worked hard, but I've been very lucky.
And you're coming of age as a playwright in a time that does feel like it is almost a funny moment where African-American, maybe playwrights, maybe others, are kind of especially free to say things about all of American society.
Hasn't it always been the writers, the entertainers, who have more freedom around... I mean, isn't that our job, to sort of hold up a mirror to our society and point out the absurdity and point out the inequalities?
Yeah, but Louis Armstrong had to, you know, stay in the other hotel and,
stayed in the other hotel sometimes.
Oh, all right, okay. We're keeping it real. Bonnie in Williamsburg, Virginia. Bonnie, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say hello to the ladies and to thank Miss Diamond for this play. I have not seen it, but it speaks more to my own experience socioeconomically as a black person than some of the other black playwrights like, say, Tyler Perry. And so I really appreciate this point of view being put on stage. And I also wanted to say that... I love black theater and plays by black playwrights and support all of them. But I wanted to tell people that there is a black theater festival that's held every other year down in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Great.
That features a lot of works by black playwrights. And it's a marvelous festival, and you see many, many talented black actors, too, where you don't always see that, except for, like, in February, mostly around Black History Month, when some of the theaters locally will roll out, works by black playwrights.
Well, Bonnie, I assure you, it's no Tyler Perry on stage. You're quite right with Lydia Diamond. It's a different slice. I'm glad for your call affirming that, and for the we'll make a note of Winston-Salem, and thanks for your call. Thank you very much. Let me get one more right here. Columbia, South Carolina. Charlie, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask Lydia about the other brown bag test. I was white, poor kid, grew up in Dorchester, dated a wealthy black girl. And her dad was in a fraternity in the 60s, and they had the brown bag test where if your skin, not that your skin had to be lighter, but your skin had to be darker than the brown bag. And it's interesting, those two tensions where you're drawn in. Does she?
Yeah, you may be her next play, the Dot Av kid dating the rich black girl. What about testing the other way? I mean, it goes both ways.
I am aware of that tension, and I think that's what's sort of delicious. You've said it very eloquently yourself already. I mean, it's all about the insanity and the inconsistencies and the socio dynamics around all of that. It's exciting and discouraging and certainly something worth examining on stage.
So in your play, this play, Stick Fly, as you wrote, which were you seeing as the bigger challenge? The upper crust African-American son bringing home the kind of more street girlfriend in Taylor, or the upper crust African-American son bringing home the white girlfriend?
Neither.
Wait a minute. They're both charged in the play. One is not a more difficult trick to pull off
than
the other.
Because isn't life just sort of difficult? And
well,
I
found that occasionally.
So I like to think that I paint my characters with enough detail and broadly enough that everyone's stuff is sort of important, and the what creates the drama, what creates the theater, is a raising and a meeting of all of those stakes.
Well, let me ask you then, just a white guy question. If they were equal on your austere scale of dramaturgy, there's no universal family here. But for an upper crust African American family, can you make any generalization about which is trickier to bring home, a white girlfriend or a black, darker than the paper bag girlfriend?
I think the dynamic weighs pretty heavily in each way, and I wouldn't presume to universalize upper crust African American mm-hmm. families and mm-hmm. their values.
Mm-hmm. Carefully and well said. Margie in Newton, Massachusetts. Margie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I saw Stick Fly last night. I loved it. I just did a blog posting about it, but we left and we were reminded of that quote by Tolstoy, all happy families resemble one another, each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way.
Yep.
And the thing is that this is not just a dysfunctional family, but because of the humor and the love that does come through, mm-hmm. it really speaks well beyond race and class and takes in gender. And,
sure does.
The directing was wonderful. The facial expressions and pregnant pauses were very, very compelling. Anybody who has had an experience, whether white or black, of going into a setting, maybe you've gone to an Ivy League school and there are unstated class distinctions there, you're aware mm-hmm. of dealing with insecurities and going into a situation where you're an outsider. I just think this was brilliantly done.
Or anybody who's ever brought a fiancé, for that matter, a girlfriend home, or or a boyfriend home for the first time. I mean, that tension is always there. And, dysfunctional, but also very functional in just that kind of complicated way that we all function. Margie, thanks for that. Let me get one more right here from Boston. Marcia, you're on the air, Marcia.
Yes, hello. Ms. Diamond, I'd like to applaud you on an incredible work. And I have a question, which is, can you reflect upon both the presence and the absence of the mother in your play.
The matriarch of the family in the big house never shows up.
Yeah, there are actually a couple of mamas not mm-hmm. there that that weekend. The maid actually, her daughter Cheryl is an important part of the cast and has had to stand in for her because she's sick. And we don't know why. You have to come see the play to know why Mrs. LeVay doesn't show.
It's just a mystery.
But they couldn't be there because that would just be a really very different play. It would certainly be on if the Mrs. came, and I think that would everyone would have to be more well behaved.
Though these two mothers, the matriarch and the maid, they're not on stage, but they're both in their way
so
powerful presences.
Present. David Gallo, our amazing designer, worked very hard to make sure that every element of the house reflected Mrs. LeVay. She decorated it. She's all over the house and in the values of her children.
Absolutely. Marcia, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Nashville, Tennessee. Rob, you're on the air, Rob.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm a middle-aged white man born and bred and living in the South, but I married into a family that had a home on Martha's Vineyard for 50 years.
So you know a little bit about that.
A little bit. As a matter of fact, it was in Oak Bluff. But my question is about the black-white dynamic, a subject which fascinates me. I read a wonderful book called White Guilt by Shelby Steele, mm-hmm. and it has to do with the use of words. And the words are African-American as opposed to black. I noticed in the exchange there between the characters, when it came to an invitation to kiss a part of the anatomy, the word African-American was not used.
It disappeared right there. Yeah. It just didn't flow.
Yeah.
Lydia, how about it? I mean, it's a great question, Rob. What about the language, the particularity of the language you've gone to and not gone to here?
Oh, my goodness. I don't even know how to respond. Certainly in that moment, black... Oh, goodness. I can't speak, and I can always speak. I don't know. What really do you think is the question?
Well, I mean, there's a whole closet full of language where we get careful when it comes to race relations.
I see.
And that black versus African-American is just one, and these days they're kind of interchangeable. I mean, I don't know. There's always nuances.
Well, and I think that what's exciting is that in this space, it's a space that is an African-American space. They own it. And mm-hmm. so there doesn't have to be that first inclination to self-censor. It's going to come mm-hmm. out the way it's going to come out, mm-hmm. and Kimber's just along there for the ride.
There's the freedom point. I mean, the other that has, I would say, pretty much nothing to do with race, but I was fascinated by here, is there are some big secrets in this play. We often learn them in the midst of banter so fast, and the reveal is it appears almost accidental. These are exchanges that are almost, maybe I'm getting colory here again, but they're almost jazz-like because you've got these very fast back and forth. And in the middle of it, someone uses a pronoun almost accidentally or by mistake that tells us a world. Mm-hmm. I sit and listen and watch that and think, what a Rubik's Cube to write. You have to imagine it not only... the language, but the flow, the tempo, the moment at which each of these notes, these words, is going to hit our ears, and how we take on board the reveal you've just given us. Is that hard?
Well, it's a strange thing. When I know the characters really well, and these characters are so vivid and so important to me, they do the writing for me. It really comes out of their mouths. And then the hard part, I think, is the structuring and finessing after they've said whatever they're going to say. But playwriting is a little like channeling. And so it's almost hard to take credit for the musicality of the language, because if I just let it be, it takes care of itself.
Rosie.
Yes, sir.
You're the white actress in this play.
Mm-hmm.
Lydia has written you right in and right in deep and ultimately given you really open and free exchanges with everybody, including Taylor, Nicole, who we heard sort of go after you earlier. Let me ask you something. Is it easier to have that nuance? Is it as easy to have that nuance of interaction that the playwright's given you in this play? Can you do it when you walk off the stage in the United States in 2010 with a black cast and you're the white actress? Mm. Can you have that same freedom? This is kind of a personal question.
Right. No, absolutely. I think it took me a couple weeks to find my voice in the room. And
did
also,
you eat lunch at a different table in the cafeteria?
They made me, yes.
Yes.
No. Well, you know, and there's like, and of course, when you're the only one, and of course, both of these ladies and the rest of my cast have experienced this their entire life in whatever cast they're in, and they're the one black actor, there's comments, you know, you're the white girl, and you take them and you say, like, that I'm so lucky to be here and being a part of the story, especially when the white person a lot of the time is sort of a joke in, or not a joke.
Though Lydia's
just,
generous to this character.
That's
she
my point,
makes you
right?
Savvy, in
exactly.
The
so I feel very lucky, and I think it took me a while to find my voice on stage and off stage because you just, as a middle class white woman, you're sort of raised with, you know, you don't know how to funnel your words in the correct way. And Kimber doesn't really either, but she just does it. And she's able to continue the dialogue afterwards and become very, I think, a very poignant friendship occurs between Taylor and Kimber. And
she's entitled and then she's let in. Our time is so short.
Sure,
Nicole,
sure.
Do you feel free in this play? Are you getting to...
I feel free, but like not because I'm so telling it like it is. I think that I feel free because I'm given language that is beautiful and that works. And as an actress, I don't think there's really much more you can ask for to help you do your job is the language that is specific and beautiful.
Well, yeah. That's pretty great. We'll take that. Lydia Diamond, here we are in a single hour. I think I've heard you compared to Picasso, Mozart, Tolstoy, Beckett, and August Wilson. Oh, my goodness. Good luck living
thank
up to
you.
That. We think you'll do it. It's a great play and a great performance, Stickfly by Lydia Diamond. It's been great having you all with us this hour. Rosie Benton, thank you very
thank
much
you
for
very
joining
much.
Us. Nicole Salter, wonderful to have you
thank
here.
Thank you for being here. Thank you.
And Lydia Diamond, what's up next? What's your next play about?
I have a lot of writing to do. Just lots and lots and lots of writing to do.
Oh, well, don't let any of those comparisons get in
no,
the way.
No, I won't let that intimidate me at all.
Not a bit. Great to have you with
thank
us.
Thank you.
Stickfly at the Huntington Theater Company in Boston. Maybe you've seen it somewhere else across this great black, white, and everything in between country. Listeners, thanks for joining us this hour. It's great to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.